You are listening to another edition of The Block Report with the Minister of Information, J.R. Valray. Today, our guest is the legendary historian, author, professor, and more, Gerald Horn.
And we just want to get updated on the world events that are taking place. It's a very hot time. You talked a little bit about it in your recent lecture that you just had. The International Court of Justice is who convicted Israel of genocide. What does that mean? What are the ramifications for Israel? And can you talk about it being in the Court of Justice and not the International Criminal Court?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. Second of all, the International Court of Justice in The Hague has oversight over cases emerging out of the Genocide Convention of 1948-1949. It adjudicates disputes between states. South Africa brought a case against Israel with regard to Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza. The International Court of Justice, in an overwhelming majority, viewed that South Africa made out a plausible case for genocide. In order to say that Israel has committed genocide, that'll take many months, perhaps even years, to accumulate the evidence to make that case. The International Court of Justice also suggested that Israel take immediate steps to ameliorate the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. There are those who have interpreted their decision to suggest that the only way to ameliorate the catastrophe is to have a ceasefire. Now, of course, the International Court of Justice did not call explicitly for a ceasefire, but it's fair to interpret their ruling in that light. Of course, the evidence that was presented by South Africa was overwhelming in terms of what they called reproductive violence. That is to say, the fact that the infant mortality rate amongst Palestinian women is skyrocketing in terms of hunger. At one point, it was adjudged that of the 80% of the cases of famine, extreme hunger in the world, were centered in Gaza, which only has a population of 2.2 million. So this was a very powerful case. You asked why it wasn't brought before the International Criminal Court, also in The Hague. Part of the reason is the International Criminal Court has dropped the ball. They have become really a tool of the North Atlantic powers. You might have noticed that disproportionately and overwhelmingly, they bring cases against leaders of Africa, interestingly enough. George W. Bush has not had to stand before the International Criminal Court, nor has his sidekick, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, et cetera. The International Court of Justice is a more balanced court to that degree, and we can expect Israel to come back to the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, within maybe 3 weeks with a report outlining how they have sought to ameliorate the humanitarian disaster. I don't think that their report will be satisfactory because you know that since the ICJ rendered their opinion, they've still been massacring people. And so what that suggests is that the case will be then referred to the United Nations Security Council, where the U.S. government would probably veto any measure. It can then go to the General Assembly, 190-plus member states of the United Nations, and depending on the language they craft that they can get an overwhelming majority to sign on to, this could form a basis for further sanctions against Israel. I say further sanctions because probably the most effective sanctions thus far against Israel have come from Yemen, where the comrades there have been launching missiles at vessels headed towards Israeli ports, which is obviously hampering the Israeli economy, which is in free fall right now. So if you look at the parallel campaign against apartheid South Africa, you'll see many relevant comparisons. For example, at a certain point, South Africa was expelled from the United Nations. There are those who are calling for Israel to be expelled from the United Nations. In other words, to further isolate and marginalize this current outlaw regime. The problem, of course, is the U.S. government, their major protector. During the apartheid era, we were able to force the U.S. administration to impose sanctions against South Africa. And that was the beginning of the end, when their chief ally turned against them because of our activism. The situation now is different because the Zionist lobby is so powerful. The apartheid lobby could not hold a candle to the Zionist lobby in terms of power and influence. As you know, people are losing their jobs because of the Zionist lobby. People are afraid to speak out. So this is going to be a very tough and difficult battle, but I'm confident that we'll prevail.
In looking at what happened with South Africa in the divestment movement, how effective do you think a divestment movement will be in terms of dealing with Israel and its genocide right now?
Well, it has a lot of potential, but as you know, potential means you haven't done it yet. But it's already in motion. You have a boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. But interestingly enough, just to draw the comparison, in states like Arkansas, if you want to, say, come speak at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, you have to sign a statement saying you're not in favor of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, for example. We did not have something like that during the apartheid era.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I was going to say that the Zionists are way more ingrained into the social structure of what's going on in America than their counterparts in South Africa. So then how would it be effective? Because you have everything from coffee shops to the record industry that are very much influenced by Zionist Israel. How do you see that being accomplished today?
I mean, you mentioned coffee shops. I mean, Starbucks is under pressure, is being boycotted in West Asia and the so-called Middle East. McDonald's, ditto. Coca-Cola, ditto. There's a lot of pressure on these major corporations because they're not just U.S. corporations, they have holdings all over the world. And fortunately, there's a world majority that's against Israel's outlaw regime. And so that's a lot of where the pressure is going to come from. And I think that ultimately, Israel will have to bow to that pressure, just like South Africa had to bow to that pressure.
The momentum that is being gained around Gaza, how do we use that momentum to stop the genocide in the Congo or to stop the century-long intervention into Haiti? How do we use this momentum to stop it?
Well, it's a difficult question, but obviously the kind of infrastructure we build up in terms of organization to pressure Israel, that infrastructure is transferable to apply to the Congo, to apply to Haiti. Now, of course, sadly, the examples are not very positive. I mean, we had this entire anti-apartheid Southern Africa solidarity infrastructure, but after South African independence in 1994, it tended to dissolve. That's not encouraging in terms of trying to use this anti-Zionist infrastructure for these other campaigns that you mentioned. But hopefully what can happen is that we'll learn the lessons of the past. Obviously, the key to a lot of these problems and a lot of these questions that you raise comes back to organization. It comes back to organizing. It comes back to mass pressure. And sadly, we don't have enough of that in the United States.
Do you think that the United States needs an anti-war movement? Does the left, does the black community? And if so, why do you say that? What lessons did we learn from the anti-war movement in Vietnam and, say, maybe even Iraq? Why do we need an anti-war movement?
Well, we need an anti-war movement because we know that just within the last 24 to 48 hours, the United States has widened the conflict in the region by bombing Syria and Iraq. We need an anti-war movement because our tax dollars pay for that bombing at the same time that homelessness continues to skyrocket, particularly in California, and we need more spending on education and healthcare as well. Now, I should mention, of course, that in the past, what happens when you have militant organizations arise is that the state tries to crush them. And oftentimes, the state is successful. And that sends a message to people that perhaps they don't want to be crushed, and therefore they don't want to be involved in any organizations likely to be subject to being crushed. But ultimately, there's no way out, because I think that all of this bombing that's taking place at the behest of the United States overseas, not only metaphorically are these bombs exploding in public housing, in public schools, et cetera, but ultimately it lays the foundation for a kind of enhanced repression, because bombing abroad is just another form of repression. And if you can execute that abroad, why can't you execute it at home? And so it's in our enlightened self-interest to campaign against this kind of thuggery abroad that the United States is involved in, because ultimately, if we don't, we'll be victimized.
Why are you optimistic about the future?
Well, because we have the numbers on our side. I mean, not only domestically, but globally. That's a reason for optimism. Now, of course, just because, you know, South Africa, they had the numbers on their side since 1652. But it took to 1994 for the regime to be dislodged. I mean, that's, what, over 300 years. I don't think that our time window is that lengthy, but it does give us hope and optimism that these repressive, oppressive regimes are living on borrowed time.
You were just listening to the voice of the author, historian, and university professor, Gerald Horn, on the Black Report with the Minister of Information, J.R. Valray. If you would like to hear more from the Black Report, hit us up on Instagram at Black Report Official. We out.